Acts 5:12 through 5:42. The 24th talk in a series on the book of Acts was presented by Jack Crabtree on December 27, 1998 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1998. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle. This is the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side.
We're in chapter 5, and let me just read the section that we're going to look at, and then we'll come back and look at it bit by bit here. I'm starting with verse 12. And at the hands of the apostles, many signs and wonders were taking place among the people, and they were all with one accord in Solomon's portico. But none of the rest dared to associate with them, however, the people held them in high esteem. And all the more believers in the Lord, multitudes of men and women, were constantly added to their number, to such an extent that they even carried the sick out into the streets and laid them on cots and pallets, so that when Peter came by, at least his shadow might fall on any one of them. And also the people from the cities in the vicinity of Jerusalem were coming together, bringing people who were sick or afflicted with unclean spirits, and they were all being healed. But the high priest rose up along with all his associates, that is, the sect of the Sadducees, and they were filled with jealousy, and they laid hands on the apostles and put them in a public jail. But an angel of the Lord during the night opened the gates of the prison, and taking them out, he said, "Go your way, stand and speak to the people in the temple the whole message of this life." And upon hearing this, they entered into the temple about daybreak and began to teach. Now when the high priest and his associates had come, they called the council together and all the senate of the sons of Israel, and sent orders to the prison house for them to be brought. But the officers who came did not find them in the prison, and they returned and reported back, saying, "We found the prison house locked quite securely, and the guards standing at the doors, but when we had opened up, we found no one inside." Now when the captain of the temple guard and the chief priests heard these words, they were greatly perplexed about them as to what would come of this. But someone came and reported to them, "Behold, the men whom you put in prison are standing in the temple and teaching the people." Then the captain went along with the officers and proceeded to bring them back without violence, for they were afraid of the people, lest they should be stoned. And when they had brought them, they stood them before the council, and the high priest questioned them, saying, "We gave you strict orders not to continue teaching in this name, and behold, you have filled Jerusalem with your teaching, and intend to bring this man's blood upon us." But Peter and the apostles answered and said, "We must obey God rather than men. The God of our fathers raised up Jesus, whom you had put to death by hanging him on a cross. He is the one whom God exalted to his right hand as a prince and a savior, to grant repentance to Israel and forgiveness of sins. And we are witnesses of these things, and so is the Holy Spirit, whom God has given to those who obey him." But when they heard this, they were cut to the quick and were intending to slay them. But a certain Pharisee named Gamaliel, a teacher of the law, respected by all the people, stood up in the council and gave orders to put the men outside for a short time. And he said to them, "Men of Israel, take care what you propose to do with these men. For some time ago, Theudas rose up, claiming to be somebody, and a group of about 400 men joined up with him, and he was slain, and all who followed him were dispersed and came to nothing. After this man, Judas of Galilee rose up in the days of the census, and drew away some people after him. He too perished, and all those who followed him were scattered. And so in the present case, I say to you, stay away from these men and let them alone. For if this plan or action should be of men, it will be overthrown. But if it is of God, you will not be able to overthrow them, or else you may even be found fighting against God." And they took his advice, and after calling the apostles in, they flogged them and ordered them to speak no more in the name of Jesus, and then released them. So they went on their way from the presence of the council, rejoicing that they had been considered worthy to suffer shame for his name. And every day in the temple and from house to house, they kept right on teaching and preaching Jesus as the Christ. Okay, several things in this passage that I want to comment on, and we'll just work our way through here and look at it one at a time. Notice this account starts by saying, "And at the hands of the apostles, many signs and wonders were taking place among the people." If you pay attention to the vast and large charismatic movement in the Christian church and Christian culture today, the picture of the book of Acts that they paint is one of people coming to Jesus, becoming believers, and because they have become believers, all kinds of miracles begin to happen in their lives. That's not the picture that we actually have in the book of Acts. And Luke makes it explicit here. He says it's at the hands of the apostles that many signs and wonders were taking place among the people. That for the most part, it's notable that the miracles are happening as correlated to the apostles themselves. In fact, it would appear that they are largely correlated with Peter, because notice a little bit later in the account, in verse 15, it says, multitudes were being added to such an extent that they even carried the sick out into the streets and laid them on cots and pallets so that when Peter came by, at least his shadow might fall on any of them. That there's such a strong correlation between these miracles and Peter that it's Peter's shadow that they want to fall on them. This is not a widespread community phenomenon where everybody is healing everybody and everybody is a miracle worker and everybody has the faith to move mountains. That's not the picture that you get in the book of Acts. And yet, we are often told that that's true Christianity, true, authentic, and real faith. My kids and I just went and saw Prince of Egypt this week because I was curious. And I was greatly disappointed, for a lot of reasons, but I was greatly disappointed in this basic, fundamental, primary theme. If you have faith, then miracles will happen. That seems to be a prevailing view in Christian culture, in the non-Christian culture, in the New Age view of life, that miracles and power is something that I get if I have the right kind of faith, the right intensity of faith, the right dosage of faith or something. That it's my faith that somehow taps into the power of God himself, and then the power of God is put at my disposal and I become a miracle worker because of that faith. It's that perspective that leads people to distort the story of Acts into one of believers becoming believers and then becoming miracle workers, because after all, they had faith, a simple faith, a non-critical faith, a non-modern faith, a faith that was a real faith, an authentic faith. And because of that, they could tap into the resources of God. Notice that that's not the picture. We have yet to see a miracle in the book of Acts that's performed by anyone other than an apostle. And Luke starts this section by saying, at the hands of the apostles, many signs and wonders were taking place. I think we have to keep that in perspective, or we are misled into a whole different view of what's going on here. He says that they were all with one accord in Solomon's portico. Remember, Solomon's portico is the eastern side, eastern wall of the Temple Mount, so it's actually in the temple, but it's a public marketplace type area of the temple. And they're hanging out there. They're just kind of, they congregate there every day and hang out, and the apostles teach them, and all kinds of amazing and marvelous things are happening. We've seen this statement that they were all of one accord several times now in the early chapters of Acts. And I think in every case, Luke means basically the same thing by it, is that they were really focused. They were preoccupied with one and only one thing, and that was to understand and experience this incredibly remarkable event, this incredibly dramatic transition from one spiritual age into the next. The darkness is passing away, the light is shining, and that transition is being accompanied by just some really dramatic events. And nothing else matters to these people except to experience it and understand it as best they can. And that seems to be the one single purpose that kept them all together, that bound them together in this particular historical occasion. he goes on then and says, but none of the rest dared to associate with them. That is, we have a hint here of what's going to follow in this story, that everyone else recognizes, however, that there's an incredible enmity between the religious establishment in Jerusalem and what's going on, what's happening in Solomon's portico. The religious establishment does not support it, they don't like it, they're threatened by it, they're jealous of it, and that's what the following account is all about. And everybody recognizes that. Everybody senses that. They intuitively grasp the spiritual difference here. And so they dare not associate with these people. It's an all or nothing sort of thing. Either you decide to commit yourself to be a disciple of Jesus or you stay away from it. But you dare not just kind of be around to be collateral damage. You don't want to do that. Nonetheless, Luke comments, the people, even though they are unwilling to associate with them, they have a great deal of respect for these people. They hold them in high esteem, Luke says. All the more believers in the Lord, multitudes of men and women were constantly added to their number. Now, what exactly does he mean? Is Luke saying that these are genuinely children of God being added to the number of the elect, or being, do you add to the number of the elect, showing themselves to be among the elect? I don't think so. I don't think that's the way to understand this. I think by believers in the Lord here, he simply means people who have been totally clueless about Jesus or have been hostile to the idea that Jesus was the Christ, all changing their mind about that and deciding that there's something to this. That this thing that Peter's saying about Jesus, it really must be true. They're persuaded by the miracles. They're persuaded by the teaching. They're persuaded by the lucidity of what the apostles have to say, by its continuity with their scriptures, by all that's transpiring. All of this is making sense to them, and it's persuasive to them, and it's convincing them. But what is it convincing them of? What it's convincing them of is that these guys know what they're talking about. Are they convinced that they want to personally embrace it and live their life in the light of its truth? Not necessarily, I think. And that's the difference between a true child of God, a true believer who will inherit eternal life, and someone who's a believer in the sense that they can't escape the force of the evidence and have to capitulate to the truth of what's going on. Many, many people throughout human history have done that, who have never personally made an existential commitment to define their whole life in the light of the truth of the gospel. And I don't think Luke is presuming to judge that about these people. He's not saying these are children of God, but what he is saying is that they've moved from being Jews who don't think the Messiah has come to Jews who are willing to admit that, yes, the Messiah has come. Partly what follows supports that, because he goes on to say, all the more believers in the Lord, multitudes of men and women were constantly added to their number to such an extent, he says, that they even carried the sick out into the streets and so on, that so that Peter's shadow could fall on them. That at first that seems like a strange transition. That seems like a non sequitur. A lot of people are coming to be their disciples, so much so that they took their sick out in the streets and put them on cots. What's that all about? I think what he's trying to paint a picture of is the city of Jerusalem filled with sick people on cots out in the streets, because the knowledge and the reputation of Peter, the knowledge of what's going on in Jerusalem, has become so widespread and so widely accepted that people are hopeful that they can be benefactors of what's going on. Maybe the one I love who's sick can be healed here as well. They are so widely believing of what's going on that they are that they're taking action, and they're filling the streets with their sick people. And in 16, he says it even went beyond Jerusalem. All the outlying districts, all the villages around the outskirts of Jerusalem, had people bringing their sick and afflicted in from in from the outlying districts into Jerusalem with the same hope that maybe they could be healed. That's what he means by believers being added to their number, I think, here. There's no commitment involved here. It's just that they are now convinced that these are not just idle rumors, these are not empty fairy tales. Something substantial is going on, and they believe that that's the case, and they want to be benefactors of it if they can. But as we know from our own experience and from all of human history, most of these people are not going to be around when the persecution comes. Most of these people are not going to be interested in being disciples of Jesus when it means being killed rather than being healed. They'll take the healing, but they don't want the killing. And I don't think Luke is saying that these are people that are prepared to go to their death to be disciples of Jesus, but they are prepared to haul their sick people out into the street. If disciples of Jesus get healing. Notice in 16 he talks about bringing people who were sick or afflicted with unclean spirits. I've commented on this before, but have we ever do we have any experience with people who are afflicted with unclean spirits? I don't think so, at least speaking for myself, I don't think I have ever had any such experience. I proposed a theory several weeks ago, or months ago actually, that the way to understand the dawning of the light that happened with the coming of Jesus, and particularly as culminating in the day of Pentecost and the events that we are now reading about in Acts, that the way to understand this is in a sense a diminishing of the power of Satan, a diminishing of the power of evil, binding Satan, imprisoning Satan. I even have suggested that Revelation 21 is about this, locking him in the abyss, is a picture of the time that we are now in. That being the case, it would seem very reasonable that one of the consequences of Satan's power being restricted is that demonic activity is greatly curtailed. That, I would argue, is why in our normal experience we don't see people afflicted by unclean spirits, because demonic activity has been curtailed by the light, by the truth that's in the world, by the purposes of God, as he has decided to silence the deceiver, as not completely, obviously, but to mute the lies of the deceiver enough to allow mankind to hear the truth and respond to it. And we live in that time right now. But the time before Jesus came, the time before Pentecost, was a time of incredible deception. And one of the manifestations of that deception, it would appear, was the activity of unclean spirits as they would enter into human affairs, enter into our life experience as deceivers and as destroyers. It would, if I'm right in my theory, that time will come again, that Satan will be released from the abyss to go out and deceive the nations, ultimately leading to the Battle of Armageddon. That will happen again, if my theory is correct. But we don't appear to be there now. At least it has not been my experience that I have ever come face to face with a real active demon or unclean spirit. Okay, now we enter into the account of this actual arrest here. The high priest rose up along with all his associates, that is the sect of the Sadducees, and they were filled with jealousy. I think this notion of the high priest rising up is, I don't think he means a physical act. I think what he means is emotionally and psychologically. It's like our idiom to get a rise out of someone, to provoke a response from them. For the high priest to rise up is for him to respond in a very dramatic and powerful and emotion-packed kind of way. He had had enough, and he wanted to put an end to what was going on here. What was provoking him, Luke tells us, is his jealousy. He was filled with jealousy. Now, what exactly would be the nature of this jealousy? I probably, in all likelihood, part of one aspect of the jealousy would have been the public approval, the public acceptance that Peter, the apostles, and this group of disciples were getting, that they were being noticed by the public, they were being accepted by the public, they were being respected by the public. Put this in this historical context, the high priests and the Sadducees were hated by the public. Jeremias has written a book called Jerusalem in the Time of Jesus that I read years and years ago, and he talks about, one of the sources of contention is that the Sadducees had a different theology from the Pharisees in many, many respects. In some respects, about how to do the ritual and the liturgy of the temple, the Pharisees had a different interpretation of what the law required than the Sadducees did. So every time the high priest would go out there and do what he did, he was an irritant to all the people because he wasn't doing it right. And it was so irritating that there were a couple of occasions where the people in the temple pelted the high priest with tomatoes because they were so outraged by the way he was performing his ceremony. There are a couple of occasions when that happened. So the high priest is not, he's in power. He's supported in power by the Romans. He has all kinds of money and political power and social standing. He has all of that, but he does not have public approval and public acceptance. Well, undoubtedly, part of the jealousy is here is a group of people who have the respect of the entire populace of Jerusalem. But I think that it goes beyond that. I know that it goes beyond that ultimately, that even below that understandable level of jealousy, we have the jealousy simply that evil always has toward good. John describes it in 1 John when he talks about the murder of Abel by Cain. That Cain killed Abel. Why? John says, because Abel's deeds were righteous and his own were evil. No other reason. Evil is ultimately irrationally hateful of good. And I think it comes down simply to good is acceptable to God. Good has the favor of God, and evil does not. And while we would all desire the favor of God, the good person desires the favor of God on God's terms. I desire the favor of God, but I also want to be good. The evil person wants the favor of God, but not on God's terms. I don't want to have to do good or love good to have the favor of God. I just want the favor of God. And it is incredibly irritating to have those good people around me having the favor of God because they were willing to accept the good. I shouldn't have to do that in order to have God's favor. I should be able to live the way I want to live and be who I want to be. And if I want to be evil, I ought to have the right and the freedom to be evil. And God shouldn't reject me for that. And that's really irritating to think that way. Especially when you're face to face with someone who is so righteous that they don't mind doing good. And God accepts them for that. Doesn't God know how uncool they are? It's really irritating. Do I sound like I understand? It's really irritating. And the jealousy that fills the heart of the evil person as they hate that good person precisely because they're good. I think ultimately that's what's going on here. These high priests, as much as they are symbols of the religion of the real God who's really there, are evil people, are desperately wicked people. And, I mean, this whole family, this whole aristocracy that ruled Jerusalem. And they recognize that that these apostles, clearly, through all these supernatural signs and wonders, and again, their grasp of the scriptures and their grasp of the things of God, clearly these people have been appointed by God and have God's favor. The high priest of all people should have God's favor, and he doesn't. And these hicks from Galilee do. It just was too much. And they are filled with an irrational hatred. So what does he do? He has them arrested, puts them in jail. and intends to call the Sanhedrin together to try them. Well, in the meantime, he throws them in what Luke calls the public jail. They're not in house arrest. They're thrown in the ordinary common dungeon for street bad guys. And an angel of the Lord, during that night, opens the gates, takes them out, and tells them that he has a message from God. I want you to go back to the temple and start teaching again. Now, what is this angel of the Lord? Could it be just a normal human being who God put it in his heart to sneak in and get them out? I think so. Unprecedented to call such a person an angel of the Lord. But in this particular case, I'm inclined to think that it's literally a superhuman, angelic type being. The reason being that we don't have any account of how an ordinary human being is sort of sneaking past the guards and how he pulled this off. You don't really need an account, I think, of how he pulled it off if it's a superhuman being. So I'm inclined to think that that's how we should take it, that this is like Gabriel or like Michael, one of those dudes, is sent by God to open the prison gates. So he does, and he has a message from God: go your way, stand and speak to the people in the temple, the whole message of this life. This is striking to me as well, this whole account. Once again, what do we want God to be? We want God to be our protector. We want God to be our rescuer. We want God to be our Saint Christopher. We want him to take care of us. We want him to keep us from having accidents, keep us from dying, keep us healthy, keep us from starving. We want him to just rescue us from any and every harm that might be in our path. Here we have the real God, who's really at work in history, who lets them out of prison in order that they can go back to the temple and proclaim the gospel and be arrested again. He doesn't send an angel to let them out so that they can escape to Bethany, or so that they can escape to Jordan, or so that they can escape to Rome. He lets them out so they can go right smack dab into the middle of danger again and do the most irritating thing that they could possibly do to the authorities in order that they would provoke a crisis one more time. And you have to believe God has a sense of humor here. I mean, that the Sanhedrin gets all called together, they're all ready to try them, they send for the prisoners, and the thing is empty. I like the way he puts it here. They didn't know what to see. How do they translate it? The temple guard captain went along with the officers. And blah, blah, blah. Oh, 24. They were greatly perplexed about them as to what would come of this. What do you do when you call a trial and you don't have a defendant? I mean, what are you going to do? This is sort of embarrassing. And then a messenger comes back. Oh, well, they're teaching in the temple. That's a really funny scene, I think. So they send the temple guard back to arrest them. They get there. The temple guard is scared to death. These people are so widely accepted by the public that they know that the public will start stoning the soldiers if they try to arrest them. So you can almost see them. Peter, would you please come back to your trial? Could we please arrest you? And Peter and the apostles go along passively. I want to talk about that in a second. They passively, they don't resist, they just go back to the trial. Let's see. They go back to the trial, and let me stop there. Let me talk about this passivity. What are we to make of that? Is Peter acting once again out of principle? Is this how Christians behave? Is this the righteous and Christian thing to do? Is that whenever the authorities confront you and are wanting to arrest you, you always say, yeah, I'm a Christian, take me, handcuff me? Is passivity always the righteous and godly and appropriate response out of them as a matter of principle? Or the alternative is, on this particular occasion, the apostles were judging that this is the right and appropriate thing to do. And not that they're setting a precedent for all time, not that they're saying to the world and to all of history, Christians must never resist, but rather this is a judgment call that they're making on this particular occasion, under these particular circumstances. I'm inclined to think that we would make a mistake if we think that he's acting out of some kind of universal, transcendent, abiding principle here. I don't see any reason to take this as teaching us that passivity is the one and only way that Christians should respond to antagonism toward their faith. I guess the closest thing we get to resistance in the book of Acts is when Paul is being whipped, beaten, by somebody somewhere. I don't remember the details, but he's being beaten by somebody somewhere, and he says, "Do you realize I'm a Roman citizen?" Which is to say, boy, are you in trouble. Because you don't have the right, without a trial, to use corporal punishment against a Roman citizen. He's taking advantage of his citizenship to mitigate his own circumstances, to mitigate the punishment. There, he's not just passively accepting whatever the authorities are giving out. We do apparently have the apostles later fleeing Jerusalem. Now, in the immediate future, we're going to have everybody flee Jerusalem except the apostles. But it seems to me eventually, if our traditions know anything at all, eventually the apostles leave to go to various corners of the world to spread the gospel. Now, was it simply on a missionary, simply on missions? Were they not driven out? Did they just go as evangelists? Could be. But on the other hand, it seems very reasonable that the heat just got so hot and they decided that it was expedient for them to leave, to protect themselves. In that case, they weren't being altogether passive. At least they certainly weren't submitting themselves to the persecution of the authorities. They were escaping the persecution of the authorities. And certainly other believers did that, if not the apostles. We know that other believers did that. And it doesn't seem to be against the objection of the apostles. Oh, no, we're Christians. We submit to persecution. They seem to acknowledge and respect and accept the fact that they were fleeing. I think what we have here is a very unusual situation. God had specifically commanded them to go back into the temple and preach again. God could have commanded them to flee to Antioch or somewhere else, but he had commanded them to go back into the temple and preach. And these men are not stupid. They know what that means. And so when the temple guard comes, they recognize that this is just, they assess it, I think, as a part of God's plan that they go through with this trial. Why the release from prison at all? Well, it's a joke. it's just a dramatic little flare of God in this thing to let his presence be known to everyone interested. But it was not there was no intent for him to allow them to escape harm this way. He had another plan for that. And what was that? Well, his plan was to use this man named Gamaliel. Gamaliel is he's a well-known Pharisee. In fact, does the New Testament teach this, or is this tradition that he was the teacher of Paul? New Testament says that, right? That Gamaliel was the rabbi who Paul learned under, was taught under. Gamaliel is very well respected. I mean, down to this day, Gamaliel is one of the rabbis that people quote and look up to a great deal. Very wise rabbi. He was evidently a member of the Sanhedrin, so he stands up in the Sanhedrin and he says, Do you remember this dude who claimed to be somebody, the Messiah or the assistant Messiah or vice Messiah or whatever, and 400 people followed him, and you know what happened to him? Romans came, they slew him, and his people scattered. And then there was Judas of Galilee. Same thing happened to him. Don't you guys realize that if we just leave these people alone, they're going to get themselves in trouble? Rome is going to get fed up with them, and they're going to come in with their armies. They've got resources we don't have. They're going to destroy them, and this thing will come to nothing, just like everything else has come to nothing. We don't really need to worry about it. Just let it run its course, and we can just sit back and watch. It's a voice of moderation here, in the sense that, remember, he says this in after verse 33, when they heard this, they were cut to the quick and were intending to slay them. The rest of the Sadducees were, or the Sadducees, I should say, were so hateful, were reacting so strongly that they wanted to kill him on the spot. And Gamaliel gets up and moderates, says, wait, let's not do anything stupid here. Now, why would that be stupid? Because look at the very difficult position that the Sanhedrin is in. The temple guard was afraid to arrest the apostles because of the people, that they would be stoned to death. They take them back to trial and summarily execute them, and the public is going to accept that? I mean, I think Gamaliel is realizing how not very politic that would be. We're going to get ourselves in really big trouble if we don't use our heads here and we don't use some common sense. How threatening is this thing before us? Well, probably not really all that threatening. It may be irritating for a while, but it's not really a significant threat any more than Thutis was and any more than Judas of Galilee was. This is going to run its course. All we need to do is wait it out. So let's not do something stupid and get ourselves in more trouble with the populace than we are already in. Let's just let it run its course. As I was thinking about this, I've always in the past, being familiar with Gamaliel's statement here, I think given him a lot more credit than he deserves. I've always taken this to be kind of the counsel of a wise and godly man who loves truth and justice and doesn't want anything wrong to be done. What really seems to support that is his comment, if this plan or action should be of men, it will be overthrown, but if it is of God, you will not be able to overthrow them, or else you may even be found fighting against God. And of course, we wouldn't want to be doing that. So let's just wait and see if this is of God. One way of reading that is that there's a real kind of openness in Gamaliel. Maybe this is of God, you guys, and we don't want to be opposing this thing that's of God. But I think that's the wrong way to read this. Remember the context here. Virtually, I mean, the vast majority, it would appear, of Jerusalem has already been persuaded by the evidence before them that something real is happening here. And Gamaliel still needs to be persuaded. I mean, you see the disconnect, you see the problem. He's aware of the same things that everybody else in Jerusalem is aware of. All the healings, the teaching, the miracles, the wonders, the signs and everything. He's just as aware as they are, and yet he still wonders if this is of God. That's unbelief speaking. That's not judicious openness speaking. That's unbelief speaking. It's put on a face of moderation. It's put on the face of reasonableness. It's put on the face of intellectual respectability. But underneath, it's just raw, flat-out unbelief. I'm reminded of the account in the Gospels where Jesus casts out an unclean spirit who's causing this person to be dumb, I think. Maybe it's deaf and dumb. But there's some physical effect. And Jesus casts the demon, the unclean spirit out, and the Pharisees say it's by Beelzebul that he does that. And then Jesus basically tells them a parable to tell them what a stupid idea that is. That probably doesn't make a lot of sense, that it's by Beelzebul. And their response to his pointing out that that's probably not a very reasonable explanation is, show us a sign that we might know that you're the Messiah. And to which Jesus responds, this is an evil and adulterous generation that's asking for a sign, and no more sign will be given to it except the sign of Jonah, that is the death and resurrection of Jesus. Why is he refusing at that point to give them a sign? He's refusing to give them a sign at that point because he just gave them a sign. I mean, what was the casting out of the demon before that if that was not a sign? I mean, how many times does somebody need to do that before they're the Messiah? And Jesus is recognizing the basic profound unbelief that's operating in them, that they could look at the evidence square in the face and still be asking for more evidence before they make up their mind. And that's sort of where we find Gamaliel. He's been faced with a whole lot of evidence in Jerusalem, and still he's feigning a kind of openness, saying, "Well, but let's just wait and see. Maybe we'll find out that this really is from God." This is a political maneuver on his part. This is a political strategy. It's a way of getting them out of a bind with some kind of grace and without having egg on their face. It's not genuine and authentic openness to the evidence and to the truth. This is sort of on the side, but I was struck in thinking about this, about the whole concept of a moderate. I think maybe it's from our ancient Greek past, I don't know. The ancient Greeks were obsessed with moderation. Moderation was just the virtue of virtues for them. And maybe we're heirs of that to some extent. But there's a strong tendency in our culture to exalt moderation as being kind of the ultimate virtue. We see that especially in our present political situation. To call someone a moderate right now is to really pat them on the back. Oh yes, you're a sane and reasonable and rational and objective and good and good-hearted individual. You're not partisan like all these other people. You're really where it's at. But we really have to be careful there. To be a moderate is not necessarily a good thing. Evil often comes and manifests itself in moderation. I think that's what you find here. This is evil manifesting itself in moderation here. It depends on what we're talking about, whether moderation is a good thing. In drinking, moderation is good. In eating, moderation is good. In lifestyle, moderation is good. In the love of God, moderation is despicable. In the love of truth, moderation is despicable. In the love of justice, moderation is despicable. But even there, we have a tendency to cut the moderate some slack. Well, isn't to be moderate to be halfway there? No. To be moderate is to be halfway gone already. To be moderate is to have turned from the extreme that we should be embracing, the extreme that we should be manifesting in our life. The extreme love of God or truth or justice or whatever is deserving of extreme devotion, it's to have not made that commitment. And all the moderation in the world cannot make up for the fact that I'm not embracing what I ought to be embracing. I'm not doing what I ought to be doing. I'm not believing what I ought to be believing. And that's exactly where we find Gamaliel. With all of this facade of decency and openness, it's just evil. It's just wickedness. But it's wickedness trying to hide its shame. Now, on the other hand, there are some respects in which moderation is at the essence of extreme righteousness. A person who loves God to the extreme and loves truth to the extreme and loves justice to the extreme is going to be moderate with respect to his openness to truth. Moderate is not really the right word, but there's a word that James uses when he talks about the wisdom from above is reasonable, he says. And reasonable may not be the best translation there, but the idea he's getting at is that it's flexible. It's not entrenched. It's not so dogmatically fixed that no evidence can move it and nothing can change its mind and we're not flexible enough to follow what we need to follow and go where we need to go. There is a kind of dogmatism and a kind of entrenchedness that's evil. And the moderate wisdom would argue that we need to be more moderate than that. That is, we need to be more flexible than that, words are escaping me here, non-dogmatic than that. And if you want to call that moderation, then in that case, moderation is extreme wisdom. is at the essence of the extremity of wisdom that we need to embrace. But it depends on what we're talking about. Whether to be a moderate is a good thing or a bad thing. But certainly to be a moderate can be the epitome of evil itself. And I think that's what we find with Gamaliel. Okay, finally, they followed Gamaliel's advice. They beat them. They flogged them and told them not to speak in the name of Jesus anymore. I mean, I think it's interesting that they beat them and commanded them not. I mean, if this is really an openness to truth, you know, you guys, these people might really be from God. Let's not kill them. Let's just beat them. They beat them, told them not to speak in the name of Jesus anymore, released them. They went out from the council and rejoicing that they had been considered worthy to suffer shame for his name. And then notice, every day in the temple from house to house, they kept right on teaching and preaching Jesus as the Christ. Notice the courage. Notice the commitment to do what's right in the eyes of God and not what's right in the eyes of men, as they told the high priest. They, even if it meant risk, even if it meant that they would ultimately be killed, they were going to do what God asked them to do. They were going to do the right thing. They were going to do the good thing. God is not our protector. God is our commander. God is the one to obey, not the one to look to for protection. God does not keep us safe. He keeps us in his will. And those are entirely different things. And that's the perspective that these apostles had. They were going to stay in the will of God. If that meant he protected them, then he protected them so that they could continue doing the will of God. If it meant they got killed, then it meant they got killed. So be it. Very, very different perspective than what we are naturally inclined to want to take toward God. But I want to make one last comment and then open it up for questions. He says, rejoicing that they had been considered worthy to suffer shame for his name. That could be greatly misunderstood and has been throughout Christian history greatly misunderstood. It's not that he's saying that these apostles thought that there was some virtue in suffering for the sake of suffering, that somehow the people who suffer were particularly spiritual or particularly saintly or particularly godlike or particularly in God's favor or something like that. That's what's behind the, those medieval orders who went through the villages flogging themselves just for the sake of flogging themselves. That's coming from the perspective that to suffer for the sake of suffering is a virtue in its own right. I don't think that's what Luke is saying here, that the apostles are thinking here. What they were rejoicing over is that they had been given the privilege to play a role in God propagating the gospel and advancing the cause of the gospel. They had been given a role to play in that. In their particular case, that meant being dishonored and humiliated publicly as they were thrown in prison and taken before the Sanhedrin and flogged and scolded and criticized. They were dishonored. But from their perspective, okay, if my being dishonored is what is required in order to advance the cause of the gospel, then it's a privilege to be able to be dishonored. Not because being dishonored is a privilege, but because playing a role in advancing the cause of the gospel is a privilege. And I think that's the sense in which they're rejoicing here. They want to be used by God to accomplish his purposes. That's more important to them than anything else in their life. Okay, I've taken this too long. We have a few minutes for any questions or comments.
I tried to give everybody else an opportunity, but it just occurred to me, Jack, this is really just kind of a comment, and you can say what you want to it. When you were talking about to be passive or not to be passive in the face of the prospect of arrest and being abused and so on, and talked about there not being a principle that told us that we necessarily must do that, what came to mind, and I thought maybe some people it might come to mind, is in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus talking about, turning the other cheek, and if somebody wants your one piece of garment, then you give them the other. I don't remember what the things are. And what struck me is, although I think there's definitely a principle that Jesus is appealing to there, I don't think it contradicts what you're saying, because I think the principle there is not whenever somebody wants to do something bad, just let it happen, but rather the principle he's appealing to there is in the context of talking about loving your enemy and that sort of thing, and that the motivation in that particular situation is like when somebody compels you to go 1 mile, go with them too. As I understand what he's talking about is, here, they did something evil in coming along and saying, here, I want you to carry this for me for a mile or something. When you go that extra mile, that was without compulsion. You did that, and in order to raise the question in their mind, why is this person doing this? I didn't make them do this one, but they did this one anyway. And so the wisdom that we're looking for in that kind of situation is, what is the profitable and loving thing to do? If my going along with something actually, I feel, has the opportunity to give something to this person, to show them that I'm not acting out of vindictiveness and that I'm actually concerned with for them, even though they're my enemy, then something, there's the potential for something powerful. But if I come to the place where I think that the evil that someone is going to do, I mean, the good thing, the wise thing to do is to strive to keep them from being able to do it. And I'm not helping them by going along with it. I'm not helping anybody by going along with it and just submitting to evil. Then that would be a very different thing, I think. Does that seem right?
Yeah, it does. Exactly. Good.
What was the population in Jerusalem at this time? Do you have any idea?
I should. I've read it. I don't know if I should venture a try. Numbers don't stay in my brain. For some reason, it didn't come equipped that way. I'm going to say 100,000, but...
So when they say...
And then it greatly, greatly... It like almost doubled during festivals like Pentecost. So whatever it was normally, it expanded greatly at a festival time.
So when they say multitudes were being added, is that... Is there any kind of definition for multitudes?
No, but what I think he's trying to do with that stuff out in the street, I think what he's trying to say is he's trying to paint a picture of this was a noticeable phenomenon. I mean, one sick person out of the street is not, it might be weird, but it's not noteworthy. But if everywhere you turn, you see sick people lying out in the street in hopes that Peter will walk by and his shadow will fall on them, that's noteworthy enough that we're talking about a significant number of people who believe this thing. I think that's the only way I can put together the connection between that description of what they're doing and the idea of multitudes being added, is that he's trying to say this was really a noteworthy and significant phenomenon going on. What I didn't comment on is there's no mention that anyone got healed that way. You know, that was their intention, that was their hope, that was their expectation, but there's no comment either way whether anyone actually got healed that way. Dad?
In verse 16 in my King James, the last words are, and they were healed, everyone. If I were a doctor, I would be envious of that success rate.
Yeah.
Does that mean what it says?
What verse is that?
16.
I don't know offhand. Let me look here. I am inclined to think from the translations that probably, yeah, and they were, and that all the whomevers were being healed. All these whomevers were being healed. Yes, it does say that. There are a number of times though where all is used hyperbolically. That is where you mean a lot of them. You don't mean all down to the very last one, but mostly they were being healed.
In the context here where they were bringing them out in the street, it would seem that they had high hopes that every one of them was going to be healed.
Mm-hmm.
So in the context, it would seem like maybe you should take it literally. But later on, we know that everyone wasn't healed that the apostles came across. They just healed selected
right.
people. So in that sense, a person might think that it doesn't mean literally everyone, and so that's why I was wondering.
Right. I'd be inclined to not take it literally, and even then, you know, all of whom? All of the sick people in Jerusalem? I don't think so. All of the sick people who sought the apostles out? Maybe. Maybe that's literally true, but I suppose I would question whether that was even true. I think the point, I'm inclined to think that he's speaking hyperbolically. He's just trying to say this was such a widespread phenomenon that you got the sense that that everybody was being healed. And in the sense that I would mean that if I said that, everybody meaning, wow, a whole lot of people were. This was a dramatic phenomenon. This was not just some isolated cases. There were a whole lot of people who experienced healing at the hands of the apostles. That's how I would take it.
Yeah, you rose my interest, Jack, about in Revelation. I don't know if you want to tackle this now, but in about the 1,000-year, where it says that he will be imprisoned for 1,000 years, Satan. How do you account the 1,000 years there? It sounded like you were saying that it's occurring. It's been occurring since then.
Uh-huh.
How do you?
As you count, that's more than 1,000, is it?
Yeah.
Well, Ron has gone a long way toward persuading me that that 1,000 in Revelation is sort of a symbol of a real lot. Yeah, precisely. Precisely a real lot, or in this case, a real long time. Without that, it's not a definitive number so much as it is a symbol of a significantly large number. Well, I do have one other comment, but I want to take some time to develop it, so I'll wait on that. I'll do it next week. Any last comment or question? Going, gone.